Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On March 23, 2021, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in United States v. Cooley. The question at issue was whether the lower courts erred in suppressing evidence on the theory that a police officer of an Indian tribe lacked authority to temporarily detain and search the respondent, Joshua James Cooley, a non-Indian on a public right-of-way within a reservation based on a potential violation of state or federal law. Anthony J. Ferrati, of counsel at Spencer Fain LLP, joins us today to discuss this case's oral argument.
To give a brief summary of the conversation, what started as an innocent Terry stop by a police officer employed by the Crow tribe on the tribe's reservation turned into a U.S. Supreme Court argument that exhibited the strain of the tribe's sovereignty against the strain of non-tribal members seeking the protection of his rights on reservations. As with any criminal law case, one of the most important things is to understand the facts. I mean, the facts are obviously important in a criminal or civil case, but there's such nuance that's really essential to some of these decisions and some of these cases that I want to spend a little bit of time kind of going through those with you a little bit. If you looked at the Crow Reservation on a map, you would find that in the south central portion of Montana is the Crow Reservation. It borders Wyoming. It borders a national forest in Wyoming, really along that northern tier of Wyoming and that southern portion of Montana. The reservation was originally about 8 million acres and has been reduced by treaty down to about 2.6 million acres. Very, very large swath of land. It covers about three counties in Montana. Very, very large area of the state. The tribe and its members have been active litigants of the Supreme Court for many years. The Crow are very sophisticated in the way that they litigate cases and work on issues before the court. May not necessarily be just because they want to advance issues, but it seems to be that between they and the state of Montana, there seem to be constant issues that raise questions. The most recent one that we deal with is Herrera versus Wyoming. That case was about 2 years ago before the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was decided in favor of Crow tribal member Mr. Herrera. And you know, another case that we will deal with while we're on this call is U.S. versus Montana. And that one involves the Crow tribe as well. So I really encourage you to take a look or review a map of the Crow tribe. Go into Google and type in Crow Reservation, and you'll really see the full dimension of this land. And what you'll see is that there are really two federal highways, a portion of another one slightly up in the northwestern corner of the reservation. But there's really two federal highways that pass through the reservation. And it's Interstate 90, which travels essentially from Boston to Seattle, and U.S. 212, a federal highway that has a portion of it that links into I-90 in the eastern portion of the reservation. The incident in question here occurred in a very remote portion of U.S. 212. The area is not known to have cellular service very remote and very, very difficult portion of the land. But the area is considered Indian country under 18 U.S.C. 1151A, which really says that any reservation and any roads that go through the reservation are considered Indian country for purposes of the statute. In February 2016, Crow police officer Saylor came up across a truck on the shoulder of the remote area of Highway 212. After some time trying to convince the driver to roll down the window, he would partially roll it down and it would be rolled back up, and the officer would shine his flashlight into the dash and could see the driver sitting in the driver's side, engine going. He finally convinced the driver to roll down the driver's side window, at least partially at that point. When he rolled down the window partially, the officer witnessed the driver's bloodshot eyes, slurred speech, reported that he appeared to be non-Indian, and there was a child in the back seat. Then Officer Saylor noticed the rifles. There's a couple of rifles sitting on the passenger seat. He asked the driver for his identification. The driver then, as he was trying to find his identification, pulled out several wads of cash out of his pockets. And there was also began some erratic behavior. There was a behavior that officers sometimes call the thousand-mile stare. And officers often are trained to watch for such behavior because it can suggest that somebody is about to become violent. So the officer unholstered his pistol and removed the driver from the car. He also found that near the driver's right hand, there was a pistol sitting in that area. There had been some fidgeting by the driver near that. It's not clear that was an indicator that he was reaching for it, but the loaded pistol was sitting right near the driver's right hand. After placing the driver and the child in the police car, Officer Saylor went to go secure the area. He called for BIA. He called for the local sheriff to come to the location, and then went back to the vehicle, and he removed the firearms and placed them on the hood of his car. He discovered while he was doing that many plastic baggies and a glass pipe. Those are often associated with drug use, and particularly the baggies are used for sale. And in this case, the officer also found methamphetamine in the vehicle. County officers and BIA officers then arrived at the scene, and in coordination of these officers, they transported, specifically Officer Saylor was asked to transport the driver to the Crow Police Department, where BIA and county officers did question him, and then he was arrested by the county officers and tried in federal court. The charges that he was brought up on were in the U.S. District Court for Montana, and there were two charges. One was for a single count of possessing methamphetamine with the intent to distribute, and the other was a single count of possessing a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking crime. On motions, the defendant argued that the evidence should be suppressed because Officer Saylor, as a tribal officer, held no authority over non-Indians. And the district court granted the suppression, saying that bloodshot eyes, wads of cash are not a sufficient basis to establish an obvious sale, obvious state or federal law violation. The appeal went up to the Ninth Circuit, and they distinguished the tribal land from a public right-of-way on public land. You'll recall I said earlier that under 18 U.S.C. 1151A, Indian country is considered to be all reservation land, including rights of way through. But the Ninth Circuit distinguished that a little bit, saying that the tribal land is separate from public rights of way on public land. A tribal officer, the Ninth Circuit said, can investigate non-Indians solely based on authority to exclude non-Indians from tribal land. but a tribe cannot exclude non-Indians from a state or federal highway. Next, they said that a stop of a non-Indian by a tribal officer on a state or federal highway, quote, must be a brief and limited one. Authorities will typically need to ask one question to determine whether the suspect is an Indian, end of quote. The test that the Ninth Circuit created was, in their terms, apparent obvious violation of state or federal law, only to detain, and that the detention could only last a reasonable time to hand over to authorities. What's noteworthy about this is that this is very different from the current Terry stop probable cause standard. And really what the Ninth Circuit did with their ruling was give or really limit, I suppose, the authority of a tribal officer to ask one question, are you a non-member or are you a member? In dissent by the in dissent on the Ninth Circuit, when it went up for en banc hearing, there was an opinion written that referred to this, are you a member or non-member, as a really problematic issue from the perspective that if you've committed a crime, it's potential that you may lie to the officer as to whether or not you are a member or non-member. If you're a non-member, they have no authority to pursue you under this Ninth Circuit rule. And as long as you're not creating an apparent or obvious violation of state or federal law, they have no right to detain you. And you, in theory, would be allowed to go on your way. So that's how the Ninth Circuit approached the question. We went on to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we had arguments on that yesterday, a great volume of briefing. There were a number of amicus briefs in the case, mostly in support of DOJ's position, but there were a number of them on behalf of Mr. Cooley as well. Counsel for Department of Justice argued an inherent authority to police that the reservation and the police on the reservation, they could conduct a Terry stop. They had that inherent authority granted to them as a dependent nation or a dependent sovereign is the term that's used in the courts, and that inherency was derived simply from their existence as a tribe. I believe that there may have been a question during argument as to where that inherency comes from. I believe it was perhaps Justice Kavanaugh who asked, does that come from the Constitution? I believe the answer that DOJ gave to that was yes, that it does come from the Constitution. I think that perhaps the more precise answer would have been to suggest it came from treaty or from recognition of sovereignty, but that was the answer that was given, and it was accepted by Justice Kavanaugh. The court really focused with DOJ on the struggle between inherent authority and some actual basis. The justices seemed to have difficulty trying to determine whether or not they could justify creating or going with some sort of inherent authority. There isn't a lot of specific case law that they could point to on that. And really, they seem to be struggling to find some actual basis. You had Robert Salito. You actually had a number of other justices as well kind of probing this question. But why not Montana versus Crow or Montana versus U.S. as the actual case is referred to? And that really comes with the question. That was an early 1980 case. And The real question that existed there was, what sort of inherent power, what sort of jurisdiction exists for the tribes? And that was actually in conflict with with the state of Montana. And so the inherent power was actually discussed, and that inherent power exists in relation to the political integrity, the economic security, or the health and welfare of the tribe. And Plains Commerce, a 2008 decision by Chief Justice Roberts, really kind of dived a little bit more into that and discussed that, if something invades or intrudes on the internal relations of the tribe or threatens tribal self-rule, such activities can be regulated. Now, that was in a civil sense, but it did provide a little bit additional color to Montana. And Justice Sotomayor questioned the United States pretty pointedly, discussing that she was not confident that even Montana assists with the justification here for the tribe, for the Crow in this instance. Justice Gorsuch raised the question of the Major Crimes Act and what if the Major Crimes Act were involved, and it was obviously not in this case, but what if the Major Crimes Act was involved? And it's a very different question in the sense that the Major Crimes Act specifically does say that the U.S. government will try Native Americans on Native American land that commit particular enumerated crimes. They will try them in the federal court. Conversely, non-Indians that commit acts against Native Americans on Indian country land are also to be tried for those enumerated acts within the federal courts. So I think that the difference for that issue is that those crimes have to be tried in the federal court, and certainly the tribe, it would not affect the outcome of the fact set that we have presented here in this case. Mr. Cooley's attorneys focus more on deputization of officers. And as I read through the materials in this, and as I read through some of the, and listened to the argument on this, I really had that question in my head to a great extent as well as, what about deputization? And the attorneys for Mr. Cooley tried to answer some of those, but I don't know that they had a important grasp on necessarily anybody other than Justice Breyer, who I think spent a lot of time trying to dwell on that conversation. And the real difficulty oftentimes for tribes with deputization efforts are a couple of fold. One, they certainly, the tribes oftentimes are happy to have that deputization to deal with non-Indians on their land. But oftentimes, because of the cost of certification, other reasons such as that, the possibility that once somebody is trained in the training that's required for such a cross-deputization, that they may actually get hired away by another jurisdiction. Some of those issues oftentimes raise concerns for tribes to engage in some of these matters. And so that's some of the difficulty that was not discussed at the hearing, but some of the difficulty that can occur with cross-deputization agreements and may restrict tribes' ability or sometimes in some cases willingness to actually engage in those. And of course, the attorneys for Mr. Cooley also discussed the Ninth Circuit decision as being the correct approach under case law.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.